This is Free Speech Radio News for Thursday, April 14, 2005. From KPFK in LA, I'm Aura Bogado. In another victory for corporate interests, the bankruptcy reform bill passes in the House. Women's rights groups are concerned with the growing number of pharmacists who refuse to fill contraceptive pill prescriptions. And thousands of experimental crops may contaminate the domestic food supply. These stories and more after these headlines.
I'm Randy Zimmerman with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. The Oregon State Supreme Court has tossed out close to 3,000 marriage licenses issued to same-sex couples in one county. Judges ruled that even if a county has questions about the constitutionality of the state's marriage laws, officials have no authority to change them. Last year, Multnomah County officials handed out marriage licenses to nearly 3,000 same-sex couples until a judge ordered them to stop. Oregon voters opted to approve a constitutional amendment to make marriage in the state only available to one man and one woman. However, the Oregon State Court left open the legal possibility that the state could institute civil unions for same-sex couples. The civil union legislation in Connecticut will be debated by the state Senate next week. The state House passed the measure late last night after approving a provision that also reserves marriage only for one man and one woman. Also in Connecticut, Yale graduate assistants voted to go on strike for 1 week beginning on Monday. Melinda Tuhus reports from New Haven.
GSO President Mary Reynolds made the announcement outside the union office where the vote took place.
I am incredibly pleased and honored to announce that the graduate teachers at Yale University voted to go out on strike. We voted by an 82% majority.
GSO represents 60% of the 500 graduate teachers in the humanities and social sciences. They are seeking health care for members' families and affordable child care, pay equity across academic disciplines, and an impartial grievance procedure. A university spokesman says the graduate teachers are students, not workers, and are therefore ineligible to join a union. The National Labor Relations Board, in a ruling last July by appointees of President George W. Bush, returned to that interpretation after the NLRB had ruled in 1998 in a bipartisan decision that graduate teachers are, in fact, employees. The unions at Yale, representing 4,000 workers, say they will support the GSO strike by joining picket lines and rallies, but their members will not strike. For FSRN, I'm Melinda Tuhus in New Haven.
Mexico's state-run oil company is the source of an ammonia spill and explosion, the most recent toxic accident from aging pipelines. Shannon Young has the story from Oaxaca.
Five workers contracted to repair a pipeline network near the town of Nanchital, Veracruz, are presumed dead as the result of an ammonia spill yesterday. Additionally, an estimated 6,000 people were evacuated from the area. Others are reportedly missing or have been hospitalized. The workers themselves are believed to have caused the accident by tapping the wrong line in the network. A Veracruz state official said that as a result of the accident, a toxic cloud wafted over a nearby river, killing thousands of fish. Yesterday's ammonia eruption occurred in the same location where a spill involving 5,000 barrels of crude turned the area into an ecological disaster zone. For FSRN, this is Shannon Young in Oaxaca, Mexico.
Police arrested a Texas oil man and two oil traders today in the U.S. Justice Department's probe into the United Nations Oil for Food Program. From KPFT in Houston, Renee Feltz reports.
The owner of a Houston-based oil trading company, David Chalmers, and a Bulgarian citizen living in Houston, Ludmil Dionysev, were both arrested. They were accused of cheating the United Nations Oil for Food Program of millions in funds intended for humanitarian aid. U.S. Attorney David Kelly said the defendants paid more than $100 million worth of kickbacks to Saddam Hussein between 2000 and 2003. The secret payments sidestepped the United Nations monitored bank account that provided funds for humanitarian goods for Iraqis. A British citizen was also named in the indictment unsealed today. If convicted, each of the three men face over 60 years in prison. They could be forced to forfeit at least $100 million in assets. The United States and other countries have been criticized for failing to fully cooperate with the federal investigation into the oil for food scandal. From KPFT in Houston, I'm Renee Feltz for Free Speech Radio News.
A deadly flu virus from the 1950s was sent around the world by mistake from a U.S. lab. Brian Zinn reports from D.C.
The College of American Pathologists, a private institution, distributed samples of the H2N2 flu virus to 3,747 laboratories in 18 countries, once in October 2004 and again in February of this year. There are no reports of people being infected, and a spokesperson from the World Health Organization says the risk to the general public is low. Health authorities in Brazil, Canada, Chile, Hong Kong, Mexico, Singapore, South Korea, and Taiwan have already reported that the labs in their countries had destroyed the samples. Canadian officials first recognized the error, then alerted the World Health Organization that the virus had turned up in labs. The 1957 H2N2 flu virus killed between 1 and 4 million people, including 70,000 in the United States. For Free Speech Radio News in Washington, D.C., I'm Brian Zinn.
And I'm Randy Zimmerman for Free Speech Radio News.
The House of Representatives passed a bankruptcy reform bill today that will make it harder for most people to wipe out their debt by filing under Chapter 7 of the Bankruptcy Code. The bill is now on its way to George Bush's desk, where the president says he'll sign it. It's considered the second major victory for corporate interest in Washington this year, following the passage of another bill to limit class action lawsuits. Other business-backed measures, such as the energy and medical malpractice bills, are also beginning to make their way through Congress. Mitch Deserich reports.
After years of being bogged down in Congress, a bill to overhaul the nation's bankruptcy system is heading to President Bush's desk. With a 302-124 vote in the House of Representatives, Congress has given its final approval to a bill to disallow individuals who earn the average of their state's income to wipe out their personal debt by filing Chapter 7 of the Bankruptcy Code. Republican Representative Phil Gingrey of Georgia says the measure is meant to stop abuse of the bankruptcy system, which he says the regular consumer ends up paying for.
Bankruptcy affects all American families. It's estimated this annual cost is $400 to every family in America, and it's time to reform an outdated and broken system.
However, opponents contend that over half of all bankruptcy claims are due to illness or a death in the family. The major backers of the bill are the U.S. Chamber of Commerce and the American Bankers Association, who have spent tens of millions of dollars on behalf of most of the country's major banks and credit card companies on lobbying and campaign contributions to lawmakers.
This legislation, masquerading as protection against bankruptcy abuse, is really a protection for credit card companies and their predatory lending practices.
Representative Alcee Hastings is a Democrat from Florida.
Increasingly, credit card companies market their product to riskier consumers, and now they want the Congress to protect them from the losses that are the foreseeable result of this ill-sighted business strategy.
Democrats in the House were denied by the Republican leadership to bring 35 amendments to a vote on the House floor. Such amendments to the bankruptcy bill included provisions to protect people who face bankruptcy because they were a victim of identity theft, to protect returning soldiers from Iraq and Afghanistan from bankruptcy due to their absences, and to stop aggressive predatory lending practices. A handful of Democrats, including Maxine Waters from Los Angeles, protested against the leadership for not allowing a vote on the amendments.
Because the Republicans have sold out to the credit card companies, and they are hurting American families.
Without objection.
And Representative Lynn Woolsey, also of California, unsuccessfully tried to shut the House down.
Mr. Speaker, I move that the House now do now adjourn in protest to a closed rule on a bankruptcy bill that hurts most Americans across the United States.
The motion is not debatable.
Mr. Speaker.
Now that the corporate sector has bankruptcy reform under its belt, it's now turning its eyes to the overhaul of the nation's energy policy. With gas prices expected to reach an all-time high this summer, Republicans are predictably using the situation to promote their energy bill.
We use every day 25% of the world's oil. But the energy bill that passed the Energy Committee yesterday would do nothing at all to reduce our demand.
Tyson Slocum follows energy policy for the government watchdog group Public Citizen. He points out that during Wednesday's House Energy Committee hearing on the bill, the committee rejected an amendment to increase fuel economy standards. What the energy bill does do, however, is allow banks, the same ones who are pushing the bankruptcy bill, to own utility companies by repealing the Public Utility Holding Company Act of 1935. Thus, companies such as Bank of America and Citigroup, who both have made attempts to enter the energy sector, could also provide water and energy services. Again, Tyson Slocum.
Investment banks could own and control utilities. Investment banks are already becoming among the largest new owners of power plants and natural gas pipelines, and repeal of this act would allow them to own outright utilities, which would be a very, very disastrous thing for consumers and for the economy.
The energy bill would also exempt oil and gas companies whose drilling techniques threaten local water supplies from federal drinking water standards. Mitch Jezerich, Free Speech Radio News.
The Arkansas House passed a bill yesterday that would require hospitals that choose not to provide emergency contraceptive pills to rape victims to refer them to a hospital or clinic that will prescribe them. Meanwhile, legislation was introduced in the U.S. Congress today that would require pharmacists to fill contraceptive pill prescriptions. Women's rights groups are concerned with a growing number of pharmacists who refuse to fill these kinds of prescriptions across the country. Dolores M. Bernal reports from the Capitol.
Many pharmacists in states such as California, Georgia, Massachusetts, and others are refusing to fill up prescriptions for birth control pills and emergency contraception.
All women who come to the pharmacy with a prescription for birth control must leave with the prescription filled.
Judy Waxman is the president of the National Women's Law Center. Waxman praised Democrat Senator Frank Luthenberg of New Jersey and Congresswoman Carolyn Maloney of New York for introducing to both houses the Access to Legal Pharmaceuticals Act, legislation that will protect the right of individual pharmacists to refuse to fill a prescription, but also will ensure that pharmacies will fill all prescriptions, even if a different pharmacist has to do it.
The problem is that many pharmacists are injecting their own personal beliefs, and they're saying, I don't want to fill this prescription. And women are facing humiliating situations, quite frankly. A number of states are getting involved in this issue, some passing laws that say it's okay for a pharmacist to refuse based on their own personal beliefs.
Across the country, pharmacy refusals are taking place in large and small chains, such as Walgreens, Kmart, CVS, and Eckerd, regardless of company policy. In some cases, pharmacists have told women that their prescription is not right or causes cancer.
The pharmacist is saying, well, it's against my personal beliefs, I won't turn it over. They're preventing the woman from getting it, even from somebody else. So it's not that they don't want to do it, they don't want the woman to have it.
Laws governing pharmacists vary from state to state. They must abide by state laws and regulations, as well as their state pharmacy board. Many pharmacist associations are considering the issue. 20-year-old Emily Sharplap was at the news conference that announced the bill's introduction.
Many, many women use contraceptives, and it's hard enough to get prescriptions for the morning after pill, and then it can only be used in a certain amount of time. And so not being able to get it filled when you need to, a lot of women are very busy, they have families, they have work. They shouldn't have to waste the time trying to go all over, trying to find places that will fill the prescription that the doctor gave to her.
In a statement issued by Senator Luthenberg, he said, quote, tomorrow it might be painkillers for a cancer patient. Next year, it could be medicine that prolongs the life of a person with AIDS or some other terminal disease, unquote. The Senate version of the bill will go to committee in the next few weeks. Dolores Bernal, Free Speech Radio News, Washington.
The European Union is considering suspending imports of animal feed from the U.S. this week after receiving shipments of genetically engineered corn. Meanwhile, consumers' rights advocates in Texas say tens of thousands of experimental crops could contaminate the domestic food supply. From KPFT in Houston, Erica McDonald reports.
Since the biotech industry first began research in the mid-80s, the USDA has authorized planting of more than 47,000 test crops. Now, consumer advocates warn that cross-contamination could mean Americans will eat engineered foods before federal regulators can vouch for their safety. A study released yesterday by the Texas Public Interest Research Group, or TexPIRG, makes a case for stricter oversight, says PIRG organizer Bill Blome.
These field tests are supposed to be conducted away from non-genetically engineered plants, when in fact there have been documented cases where they have been grown near plants. We know that pollen drift occurs, but we don't know a whole lot about it. until we know more about this, this is a genie that we shouldn't let out of the bottle.
At a local farmer's market, independent growers like Joan Gunderman promise customers fresh organic produce. Gunderman wants the USDA and the EPA to do its own research into biotech safety before authorizing crops that could put her farm at risk.
Most of us organic farmers are not certified by the government for government programs, so we don't get handouts. There's no insurance to assure us against GMOs. When we lose it, we lose it. We've lost our livelihood. If I have to go to the extra extent it takes to raise an organic product, and the government needs to be able to back up what we're doing. Chemical companies have money to research, then the government needs to get out there and research it also and follow up with it better to assure that what we are selling to the public is safe.
In addition to independent safety research, consumers' rights groups and organic farmers want laws in place to protect small farms and hold biotech corporations liable if and when contamination occurs. From KPFT in Houston, I'm Erica McDonald for Free Speech Radio News.
A moment of silence was observed as part of the activities to mark the 11-year anniversary of the Rwandan genocide. Witnesses gave moving testimonies at a landing site at Golo in the Mpigi district next to mass graves of victims of the genocide. Joshua Chalimpa reports.
At this particular spot at Golo landing site, memories of the 1994 genocide far away in Rwanda are still fresh 11 years after the genocide. Silence descended on this venue as guests, including Uganda government ministers and ambassadors, moved around five big mass graves where 955 victims were buried after their bodies were retrieved from Lake Victoria. Namsi Victoria was one of the witnesses who supervised the retrieval and burial of the bodies from the lake.
One scene that will never get off my human computer is that of a middle-aged lady, decently dressed in a beautiful kitchen, about 1.5-year-old baby on her back carrying a doll, two girls and one boy who looked to be 3 years, 5 years, and 7 years old, pierced together with an iron bar through the chest, while their legs were also tied together with wires. The five bodies came in one bundle. You begin thinking of a human being who can do that. It was a terrifying scene for us, and one that I'll never forget. As a peace builder myself, I believe in moving on, and it is at this stage that I would like to thank to all those in Rwanda who are handling the process of reconciliation and healing the wounds of those who lost their beloved ones.
Several years after the Rwanda genocide that left close to 800,000 people dead, the question that lingers in the minds of most people here is, where was the international community as the mass slaughter went on? This was the same question that Angelina Muganza, Rwanda's state minister for labor, who represented Rwanda government at the ceremony, was still posing.
Why were 1 million people killed in 100 days? I think that why question is not only with the people of Uganda or the people of Mpigi district or the people of Golo, but this question is everywhere. Rwandans still ask the same question today. Why were people killed? What was wrong with the killers? We ask the questions, where was the international community? The only thing we can do now is to reflect on the past and possibly renew our commitment to the never again.
As part of efforts to guard against this and realizing that the international community may not respond to requests for intervention, Rwanda, Uganda, and other African countries in the region are creating an East African standby force to provide peacekeeping in times of need. Ugandans witnessed the genocide in Rwanda as bodies dumped into the tributaries of the Kagera River, originating in Rwanda, floated up the different landing sites in Uganda. There are six burial sites, four in Masaka district, one in Rakai district, and another in Mpiji, containing 11,136 bodies. Every year, Rwandese communities in Uganda and Ugandans flock there to commemorate the genocide. This year, the ceremony was presided over by the Anglican Bishop of Kampala, Zack Nringie.
What went wrong? We must ask these difficult questions as we remember those 100 days. For we must ask that question so that this evil must never be repeated here, there, or anywhere among humanity. We ask it of our leaders in government and outside government, the politicians and those who think are not politicians. What went wrong? What is frightening is that this evil and its perpetrators were human beings.
During the commemoration, certificates of recognition were given out to those who guided the retrieval exercise during those very difficult days. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Joshua Charimpa reporting from Kampala, Uganda.
Albuquerque, New Mexico's sprawling suburbs are threatening sacred places of its original inhabitants. One such area is situated near ancient volcanoes on the west side of the city. Most of the 17-mile-long cliff created by ancient eruptions is protected by its status as a national monument, but the city plans to extend a major thoroughfare through part of the monument to accommodate existing and future development. As Leslie Clark reports, proponents of the road extension say it's inevitable and necessary, while Native Americans and others in the city say it's desecration.
We're looking at a series of petroglyphs.
Helen Wright is a 17th generation New Mexican. After living many years in Los Angeles, Wright has retired in Albuquerque. On this day, Wright's friend Sunny Wiaki joins her as she climbs the 400-foot boulder-strewn escarpment that defines the monument.
One of them is of the figure of what would seem to be a person, probably about the size maybe of what a person would actually be if you measure it. And around it are other ones of animals, sort of a bullseye kind of thing, a great cluster of them. And my understanding is that none of these were put in place without taking into account the orientation, the total context, that it wasn't just random.
Sunny Wiaki traces his roots to the Zuni and Cochiti Pueblos of New Mexico and to the Navajo tribe. His ancestors could have made some of these drawings. Wiaki says the petroglyphs aren't just relics from some long-dead religion.
If you take a look at us, as Native Americans, we believe, you know, we were born on this land. One of the most important reasons we use this area is because it's a place of prayer. So a lot of our religious leaders come out here to communicate with the spirit world.
19 different pueblos share the ceremonial space of the escarpment. They've been fighting the expressway through the monument for more than a decade. The Navajo Nation, too, has come out against the road, according to Wright.
If all else fails, I and my friends have every intention of standing in front of the bulldozers. We just feel passionately that this is a treasure that we can't allow to be violated.
But Albuquerque Mayor Martin Chavez disagrees. Chavez says the road was part of the deal when the area was preserved as a national monument years ago.
I'm very proud that we've been able to save this area. There are very few cities in the United States, actually I don't know if we can name any, that have done what the city of Albuquerque has done, preserving this an area like this one. It's a difficult issue. It's one that certainly has lent itself, unfortunately, to hyperbole and diatribe. But those who have looked at it dispassionately and with thoughtfulness have all come to the conclusion. Every single study has indicated there are no reasonable, responsible alternatives.
The National Trust for Historic Places, the Sierra Club, the Sacred Alliance for Grassroots Equality, the group Wiaki heads, and other New Mexico organizations are suing Albuquerque government to stop the expressway. Construction of the road was planned to begin this spring, but has been put on hold pending the outcome of litigation. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leslie Clark in Albuquerque.
Wisconsin State Assembly has passed two bills that seek to relax environmental regulations for industry by giving the Department of Natural Resources more leeway to allow factories to pollute and limit the ability of the public to contest that pollution in court. Campaign watchdog groups and environmentalists are lambasting the speed with which the bills were passed in the Assembly and the lack of public input in the process. Steve Zelaznik of WORT has the story.
The bills were submitted 2 weeks ago. Just a day later, the state held public hearings. A week after that, both bills were being voted on in committee. 400 citizens had signed a letter by then against the bill, and about 50 people packed the committee hearings. Most of them never got to speak on the bill, so one representative, Tony Steskounis, tried to hold off the vote.
You know, I had less than 24 hours to read up on the bill, and certainly members of the public probably weren't even privy to whatever that updated language was.
But the Republican majority refused to hold another hearing, and the bills were approved in committee. Another week went by, and the state assembly approved both bills. The bills still have to go through the Senate and to the governor's desk. Governor Jim Doyle says he's likely to sign the legislation.
You know, we've got a lobbyist legislature that is listening to the big campaign donors.
Mike McCabe heads the watchdog group, the Wisconsin Democracy Campaign.
The folks who want this legislation have given nearly $9 million in campaign contributions. They've given 13 times more money to Republicans who control the legislature than opponents of this legislation.
The first bill, 277, would let small polluters operate without renewing their emission permits. The second bill, 278, would limit the ability of the public to challenge any pollution in court. The first bill, 277, has the blessing of the Department of Natural Resources. Lloyd Egan at the DNR says the law would only apply to small sources like print shops and dry cleaners.
We're looking at about 6% of the total amount of emissions that would come to the state. So it's, you know, a small number in terms of pollution. It may be a large number in terms of little sources.
But the director of the Wisconsin League of Conservation Voters, Carrie Schumann, isn't convinced.
You know, I do believe that with the current DNR staff, their intention is to only allow it to be small sources of pollution. The reality is, if that's not written into the law, obviously these industries will take every advantage to, you know, basically to make sure they can take part in this loophole, even if they're a very large source of pollution.
But the controversy isn't so much over Assembly Bill 277, but rather 278. For years, local governments, citizens, and attorneys general have been able to contest pollution with a process called a public nuisance suit. 278 would forbid attorneys general from filing such a suit. George Meyer with the Wisconsin Wildlife Federation says these public nuisance suits have protected much of the environment.
Over 100 years ago, there was a proposal passed by the legislature to drain Muskego Lake and turn it over to an agricultural interest. The attorney general was able to bring a nuisance action to prevent that from happening. This bill would take away those rights.
And for Madison resident Ann Chacon, who lives behind a die-casting factory, the effects of these bills are scary. Chacon says the pollutants are already so bad that she wears a gas mask to bed.
There are no scrubbers, no filters, no electrostatic precipitation. There's no pollution control at KIPP with the exception of, something called a bag house. But I'm, you know, basically everything that comes out of KIPP is coming out of the factory without any controls at all.
Chacon and her neighbors have been contesting the pollution of the KIPP factory in court this week. If these two bills pass, then Chacon's efforts may come to a halt. The effects may be similar for other lawsuits across the state. Because Governor Doyle will likely sign these bills, opponents are banking their hopes on the state Senate. Many opponents of these bills hope a more thorough debate will occur there, and no word yet on when the Senate will take up these two bills. Steve Zalaznik, Free Speech Radio News, Madison.
Free Speech Radio News is produced at Pacifica stations WBAI in New York, KPFK in Los Angeles, and KPFA in Berkeley, and community radio station WMNF in Tampa, Florida. The newscast is produced by Monica Lopez and Simba Russo. Headlines editors are Randy Zimmerman and Nell Abram. DC editor is Mitch Jezerich. Our technical production team is Jay Paget-Seekins, Pauline Bartolone, Mick Millen, and Eric Klein. Special thanks to Transbay for web services. For archives of this or other newscasts or documentaries, visit our website, www.fsrn.org. That's fsrn.org. In Los Angeles, I'm Auda Bogado.